Welcome to Share Talk, the only podcast where investors come first.
Hello and welcome to Share Talk. It's a Share Talk webinar with the chairman of Red Rock Resources, Andrew Bell. How are you today, Andrew?
I'm very well, and happy new year to you, Zach.
Happy new year. It's been fantastic so far, really. It's been absolutely incredible. But for Red Rock Resources, it's actually not too bad over the pandemic. Is that right?
No, the pandemic has not been bad for us at all.
I mean, how would you compare where Red Rock is now as opposed to a year ago, just when we were sort of going into the nightmare that we've got currently?
Well, a year ago, we didn't have Australia to start with, our interest there in Victoria, in the goldfields. We didn't yet have Kenya back, and we didn't know how DRC would resolve. So that's three huge differences. And the gold price, of course, was much lower, which influenced the way we looked at things, because it influenced the way whether the market was prepared to back us or not. We also, of course, had a much weaker balance sheet at that time. We had over £800,000 of convertible loan notes, with the stock trading below the exercise price, and our Pyrometal Resources price was worth probably a tenth of what it is now. So we've also raised some money in September, as you know, at a price much better than where we were trading a year ago. So huge differences both to our balance sheet, our finances, to our market position, and to our asset base.
And so I presume that a combination of the better pricing and maybe more time on your hands as well, but a better commodity price inflation has just gone through the roof over the, you know, hard assets have gone through the roof, and even soft assets like cryptocurrencies, which are based on not a lot, they've gone up as well. So we've had a sort of an inflationary cycle kicking in properly now, the one that we were waiting for in 2008, 2009, 2010. That's kicked in now, and that's actually helped you to organize, explore, and generally revamp yourself. Is that right?
Yes, and of course, I belong to a generation that didn't grow up on the internet all through the night, either playing games or writing code or anything. So this experience of lockdown back in the spring was something quite new to me, because it meant that I now understand how it is that the hours blur into each other, and you suddenly find yourself not working during the day, but you can get to be working all night. Because I started looking at Australia, and there was a project there that came up, and we and Pyrometal Resources looked at it jointly. And then when I started looking at the ground around and the opportunities, I find myself up at Australian hours, I should say Melbourne hours, very many nights, and we put together a portfolio out there. And I think that wouldn't have happened without lockdown. So we owe that at least to lockdown.
And I mean, in terms of success, I mean, let's say your opening statement, you know, you've got success in that sense that you've got rising prices, you've got into Australia, you've rejigged the company. It's a multi-pronged company, and projects are more advanced than they were a year ago. But what will success look like from this point going 1 year down the line?
Yeah, well, two or three things. In a year, we hope that Australia Gold will have seen a liquidity event, which was likely to be an IPO. Maybe two liquidity events. Maybe we joint venture some of it or sell part of some of it and we IPO the rest. And then investors will be able to measure the value anyway of what we're left with. We hope if we get an IPO, we'll be able to raise funds to do proper exploration on a much larger scale. So that's Australia. We think we're on a track there. And at least one out of, say, two Kenyan and three, say, DRC projects will have achieved escape velocity. I mean, I think there are five projects there that have the potential to do it. In Africa, you can never quite tell how long things are going to take. Once you get them out of the sort of stage of needing permissions for things, the stage where you just develop it yourself, things can be quicker. But let's assume one of them might get escape velocity. Jupiter's, and any one of them, by the way, getting escape velocity, as I call it, would transform the value of the company. Jupiter's iron ore will be floated out, IPO'd out from Jupiter in the first quarter, I expect. And even royalties from Colombia will have ratcheted up. And it goes without saying that we expect our holdings in Jupiter and Parmetal Resources to make further gains.
Right, I've got an interesting question, slightly different actually from the normal. They're like, you know, why did you do this? Why did you do that? Why did you get it wrong or why did you get it right? Could Andrew explain what internal process he needs to follow when buying an asset? What are the checks and balances? I suppose it's like a due diligence question.
Well, we've always worked on the principle, I think, that one vote against or one person with serious doubts is enough to kill any initiative. So we work by consensus. But I think in the case of the only real new initiative we've taken this year, which is very significant, which is Australia, we are also going hand in hand with Parmetal Resources. So I needed Paul Johnson's agreement to every step we took along that route, and we took them together. So not an easy question to answer, because we're coming out of a period where we had 3 or 4 years, really quite bad. And because we hadn't got our Kenyan licenses back, because they'd been stuck in litigation with the government, that really acted as a barrier to everything. We needed to prove we could get them back, be able to write that money back onto the balance sheet and so on before we could progress. So in order to get through that period, we had slimmed down very considerably our manpower, and we didn't take a lot of decisions. I think the ones we did take probably didn't benefit from the fact we didn't have enough people around to consider them. Going forward, going back to the size of company we used to be, and I hope far beyond, we, of course, are going to be staffing up, and so there'll be good staff work done for all our decisions from now on. And I think also, you know, we have to look at the board and how to strengthen it. That's a very obvious aspect. But when we were a small company, who were we going to attract onto our board? With the prospects we have now, who would not want to be on our board?
Well, I'm waiting for the call. I'm interested in the Parmetal the tie up there, and also Australia, because Parmetal is, you know, it's been quite a high profile, you know, Paul Johnson's a high profile sort of force of nature on the stock market in recent years. So that's obviously going to, some of the pixie dust and publicity is going to rub off on Red Rock, even though obviously you've been quite high profile yourself, obviously, no shrinking violet. And then going to Australia, Australia's like the hottest area in mining, especially in the post-pandemic period. I mean, is it more than just the PR and more than just, you know, just chasing a gold rush, the whole Australian move and the Parmetal move?
I think the arguments for Victoria are extremely good in their own right. First of all, it was one of the biggest gold rushes there in the 1850s. You look at the amounts of money. You can say that the Victoria gold rush made Australia. Of course, it's what paid for all the nice buildings in Melbourne, induced a lot more immigration. It made Australia. Australia wouldn't be Australia without it. But for a century, people had moved away from there because they'd got the gold that was lying on the surface, essentially, near it. And considerable opportunities arose, for example, in Western Australia. And then Victoria became quite populated, and nobody wanted people scraping around at the surface so much. It's only very recently that the government there has become more friendly to mining. It's still probably very bureaucratic by Australian standards. So if you're an Australian explorer, you'd probably much rather be in WA, where you might have to deal with some native title group. But after that, unless you have some environmental issue, it's not going to be too difficult. The Victoria is more like Africa, where you have people living everywhere and they all have opinions, and you have to have a constant effort that you can't ever stop sustaining to explain to them, to talk to them and keep them on board. So I think the hour of Victoria has come, not just because of the better attitude by the Victoria government, but also because of the geophysics program started by the Victoria government back in about 2005, looking at the northern part of the state, where it's under the river soils, and therefore people hadn't explored in the past, and they wanted people to look at that Murray River Basin and do deep exploration, and for that you needed to use geophysics. So they did the geophysics, they published it, they got the interest, people went and pegged, and then using some of the geophysical interpretation, they drilled, and in the right place they found gold. So then people started looking, saying, well, this is what you get undercover in the north, why do we assume all the gold ran out a few meters down in the center of Victoria and so on? And if we can reinterpret that and use geophysical techniques, can't we find a lot more there? And so people have had one or two discoveries in the last few years when the pace of exploration has really picked up. But the fact that the gold price picked up this year as well, it meant that there was a concatenation of circumstances, a combination of circumstances that provide an almost perfect environment. So you've obviously got the big mine in the north of Kirkland Lake, which has produced prodigious grades of gold in 2020 and keeps on increasing. You've had the Fosterville South Company listing on the TSX and being very successful. One or two other companies have been successful. I see no reason at all why we couldn't get quite a good reception in the market for what we have. And then when you look at 2020, it's like water behind a dam accumulating. You couldn't get much in the way of programs approved. You couldn't spend much of that money because of lockdown. So lots of people are sitting there with programs, they're cashed up, they're hungry, waiting to explore. And given the relatively high success rate that's been so far in the last, say, 4 or 5 years in Victoria, once that money gets to work, it should produce results. And that's going to be, you know, if you're an explorer, that's what you want, is people around you and your neighbours making discoveries.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of that, I think I've got a question pre-prepared before and also on live as well. On track in Australia, what date is the mining committee meeting? And when do you believe that the licence will be granted?
Well, my understanding of the way the system works, and our geology manager used to do the same thing in New Zealand for the New Zealand government, so I think his understanding is probably correct, is you make your way through the department and they take all the things quite seriously there, the fit and proper person test, whether you've got enough money, whether you look substantial enough to carry out a proper program, whether you look as if you're going to observe the environmental rules, not get into trouble with the local communities. And then when they've sort of put ticks on those boxes, it goes up. They do a kind of internal audit on it to see they haven't missed anything. And at that stage, they stop looking at it individually. And in the meantime, you know, they may have come back once or twice with questions which you have to answer. But at that point, it ceases to be looked at individually. And you get a kind of batch system where the committee meets. They get a whole batch of things they look at and they approve. And then those papers all get taken in a batch to the minister for signature at some point. Obviously, the minister isn't going to be wanting to sit there signing one or two of these things every day. So I believe we're now at the stage where we're on the train in a carriage with other people waiting for these things to happen. But there came a point before Christmas where everything really stopped moving. And that's understandable. The volume of work for the department has hugely increased. Their plans to staff up to meet it were put off by a very severe lockdown. They were working from home. And then Christmas comes. Of course, Christmas there, Victoria and Melbourne have a winter that's quite cold and chilly. And as they say there, you can have four seasons in one day. When the summer comes, which is this time of year, they really notice it. And they have Australia Day at the end of January. So they have Christmas, they have New Year's Day, then Australia Day in January. Over Christmas and New Year, they take a couple of weeks holiday and go down to the beach. So we knew a little bit before Christmas things are going to stop. this week is really when people get back to the office. And of course, we're chasing things up. But we have to, although we chase things up, we have to recognize that there are a lot of other cases similar to ours. And so we are going to, it's going to happen when it happens. It looks as if it's pretty close, but don't ask me to say if it's going to be this week or this month.
Okay, I've got an intriguing question, which I will try and cleanse because it's not perhaps as politically correct as it could be. But I think the gist of the question is, how do you do business in environments where the perhaps the rule of law is not quite as rigorous as it may be in the United Kingdom?
Yes, of course, we operate in some jurisdictions where there are different ways of doing things. You know, people can go and they, to put it frankly, they can try and bribe their way through the system. That doesn't work terribly well because once people hear that you paid one person once, what's going to happen? Everyone's going to have their hand out, and they've got no interest really in finishing the process because they can carry on creating artificial obstacles that then need to be removed forever. On the other hand, you know, they have laws, and you can use those laws, and you can take people to court, and you can also be very, very patient, because one of the weapons, of course, that's used in a lot of places is the papers sitting there on someone's desk, and you go in there and say, is it ready? They look at the pile, and you can see you're halfway down, and in order to get it to the top, you pay something or you don't, but they expect people to take the initiative and perhaps, you know, pay. And if you don't, if you decide to do things the proper way, it doesn't mean that things aren't going to happen. It just means that you have to be patient. But we've got quite good at being patient, and we've also got quite good at going to court where we feel our interests are threatened, because we took the Kenyan Ministry of Mines to court, and now we end up several years later with our licenses back.
So a straight bat and playing the long game, I suppose, is the right answer.
Well,
that you're trying to suggest.
Probably your ancestors, like mine, occasionally went and watched the game of cricket.
Yes, I think they probably did. On to an interesting question, just because, I mean, you have quite a sprawling business now. I think it's probably a fair one to ask. What are your top three assets? I suppose it's like asking you who your favourite children are, but... I'm going to ask you the question that an investor has asked.
Well, of course, Africa has very high-grade assets, which is the attraction there, and is undiscovered assets. There are many opportunities. So you go there, but then the political risk, the delays that can occur, things like that, you might want to balance it. So you have assets in somewhere like Australia to balance it. You're always trying to find a balance, because particularly as a pre-revenue company or one without enough revenues to sustain its exploration, the worst thing that can happen to you is you run out of money and you go out of business because you become so unfashionable nobody wants anything to do with you. So you have to have something in reserve always. The first rule of success is not to fail completely. So we've always... I mean, we're really only active in three countries, which at the moment are Kenya, Congo, and Australia. And in Australia, we really have a good local team that is doing the work. Apart from putting the proposition together, taking it forward will be dealt with by people there. We also have good local people, I think, in Congo, where the people there, because there's really one style of mineralization you're looking at, they are the world's experts at it, and you can get some very good people. The places where we have interests elsewhere, Colombia is a place we did bring something into production. We sold it a number of years ago, so what we're getting is gold royalties from that. In South Africa, our interest is through our shareholding in Jupiter Mines, which we were at one time the biggest shareholder of. And we brought our friends at Pallinghurst in, and they then put in their South African asset and developed it. And we still have the residual holding there. But if you look where we're really active, it's only those two countries in Africa, which are more or less in our time zone, and you can get to quite easily from London, and Australia. And Australia is not difficult to manage because you have superb human skills there, some of the best mining people in the world. And if you put in sort of missing elements and work with them, it would be very successful. I wouldn't presume to go to Australia and start telling them how to do exploration, but we can perhaps contribute a little.
Right, and there's a question here which maybe, again, another one which needs a little bit of finessing on my part, but I think in terms of one of the recent updates, a shareholder suggesting that you didn't mention, let's say, the Red Rock Coal extending its loan facility until maybe a bit later than you could have. You were discussing other details about, you know, the, Australia or other activities.
That was some time ago. I don't remember all the facts. There's probably a justifiable criticism in there somewhere. I can't remember all the details.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was just you mentioned, let's say you mentioned late that Red Rock Resources Coal had extended its loan facility and was pledging most of the Jupiter and Power Metals shares against it.
Oh, no. Sorry. Red Rock Coal is, in fact, a wholly owned company. We thought of using for something else, but it's a wholly owned company of Red Rock. So it is actually just Red Rock. There's nothing different about it. It doesn't have any independent shareholders. It has no independent assets.
Right. So it's a sort of bit of getting a bit of the wrong end of the stick.
Yeah, I wouldn't make too much of it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And then the other point is, I suppose, a little bit on that theme. As you're invested in Jupiter and Power Metal Resources, as your investments in those entities are now worth nearly £4 million, could or should you sell them to provide funding for other projects?
And that's a question we've been asked quite often. I would say that, you know, one needs, like the investment banks in London sort of 30, 40 years ago, the accepting houses, they had inner reserves, which some people thought were a bad idea. But the banking market can be quite risky, and you don't want to go out of business. Now, for us, having these investments there, first of all, look at Jupiter. It's strategic. We helped put it together. We were in manganese for many years before that. And the contacts through that are very valuable. They give us a window. But very importantly, our iron ore assets are stuck in there too, the ones we sold in there. And we have a royalty that could be worth a huge amount of money on the main iron ore asset. So for us to keep an eye on that and to make sure that it was eventually either developed or floated out was a very legitimate and important reason for maintaining our interest there. And it has proved to be so, because the decision to float out the iron ore assets this year, which is going to happen, I think, in fairly soon, was something that was much discussed last year. And we played our part in arguing very strongly for what has actually happened, because we saw no prospect of Jupiter developing those iron ore assets so long as they remained in Jupiter, because Jupiter was concentrated on the manganese, and that meant we had a stranded asset. So for us, there were a number of reasons why we quite wanted to maintain our interest in Jupiter. Another of them was, of course, we'd sell, but when you've got a return on assets and return on equity, the last 4.5 years of 28%. Now, fund managers measure the success of the companies they invest in, usually by return on assets or return on equity. In Jupiter's cases, they're the same because it doesn't have debt. But anybody who could find things over 20%, that's heaven. As a fund manager, that's what you want to find. Because Jupiter has been so very disciplined about its dividend policy and about sticking to what it does well, it's produced those returns. So in terms of the income we've had from it and its ability to sustain the administration of the company over these years, it's been very valuable. And to sell something that is on basically a yield of up to 20%, where are you going to replace that? What are you going to find that's going to be better? So we sold a little bit as time's gone by, but we've kept it. Now that the iron ore is floating out this quarter, I think there's going to be much less of an argument for holding Jupiter. but we'd still like to see the price about twice where it is now. And I'm convinced that if the price doesn't go to that, there will be a takeover bid for it, in which case you will end up making twice your money anyway. When it comes to Power Metal Resources, we put in 100,000 a year and something ago. We have known Paul Johnson for a very long time. He made a lot of money originally in Red Rock Resources in 2010. And I had every confidence that with him, we were going to make money there. So we've actually turned that 100,000 into 1.2 million. And is the game over? No. But is it probable that when we have to exercise our warrants, which we are meant to do by February, are we going to put all that money back into Power Metal Resources? No, probably not. We'll probably see our shareholding remain the same or get larger, but we'll get some money returned to us. But I think having that there, bad times do come in these markets. The iron ore price at the moment is, say, $170 for high-quality fines, and for slightly lower-grade fines, $155 a ton. It was 20-something dollars. Back in 2010, 2011, it was maybe $170, $180. Then it came down to $20 or $30, and it's been sort of $40 or $50 for a while. And in the last year, despite the slowdown in the world economy, despite COVID and everything, it's gone up. First of all, it was over 100. Now there are spot, it's settling spots at $170 or $180. And I understand exactly why. It's because iron ore, like gold, like oil, has two prices. One is the price at which the big producers can produce extra production, say Rio's or BHP. I'm sure if you said to them, increase production at under $30 a ton, they could do it. But the price at which people bring on new projects, you'd have to, all the capacities used at the moment, you'd have to build new railways and new ports, new port capacity, new railway capacity, to pay for that infrastructure and to develop a project and get it from where it comes out of the ground to a port. You're going to need prices of probably $160, $200 to give you that degree of certainty that it's going to work. So back in 2012 or so, when the market came off, what did the big companies say? They said, oh, we can gain market share. So they produced more at $20 or $30. A few years on, and they look at total demand for iron ore and how much they've still got of that low-cost product that they can bring on, they may say, hang on, we could do that, but it makes more sense for us not to gain market share and just watch the price settle at higher levels. You can't say what the price is going to be in a year or 2 years' time. But what you can say is that looking at other companies in Australia in the iron ore space that are relatively small, they've gone up three or four times in a relatively short period. And Jupiter's spin-off is going to hit that exactly. And if that gives the fundraising capacity to start developing those iron ore assets, then our 1.3% royalty over Mount Ida, which is a 1.8 billion ton magnetite with very good characteristics, becomes valuable, because if the DFS is done, if it comes into production, we collect $8 million for 0.45% of that royalty, which takes us down to 0.85% or something, which would be theoretically values that royalty at $13 million. But in fact, if it came into production, the annual payments of the royalty would be very substantially higher, probably, than that. So that asset is something we have had in our back pocket. Its moment may have come. And 2021 will at least see some progress there, and we can choose, you know, what to do with the investment.
Right. I think actually somebody's had a little jibe saying, what was the question again? I think the answer is, I suppose, I had the same kind of question with Paul Johnson a couple of weeks back when he was on this particular Q&A session for Power Metals. And I think the conclusion then was that you probably got it right when you got an equal number of people saying that you should sell or you should stay in. And you probably got it right when you've got half the people saying you've got too much money in the bank, what are you doing? Yeah. Or you've got too little. I mean, it's if everybody's equally, you probably got it right. It's like
you're
the
right. I agree. If we've got, say, £4 million of investments, if you look at the projects we have, if we started trying to bring any of them into production, actually £4 million will go nowhere. It's we can either raise that money or we can't. The £4 million is unlikely to make a difference. What the £4 million could make a big difference to is if bad times come, seeing you through without losing any of your significant assets and going backwards.
Okay, I just want to try and if we can have just two or three sentence answers to some of the questions that have come in.
Okay.
I hope so everybody feels that they're wanted and loved. I think that would be quite good. There's a question regarding succession at Red Rock Resources. I'm not quite sure whether you want to answer that, whether you've got an heir apparent in place. That's one question. Another one is, what's the risk for the shareholder in Red Rock? Is it a punt or is there an interesting risk reward situation at this time? So succession, risk reward. Another one is to do with Chinese geologists going to Kenya. Have they had their vaccines yet? So can they go there? And then finally, a question regarding El Limon. What contribution is expected in royalty payments there? Those are just the few that have come in. But just so that people know that I'm sort of on the case.
Okay. Which one would you like me to answer first?
Succession. Andrew Bell Jr.?
Well, there's an Andrew Bell Jr., but he's actually running another company. As we develop these projects, if you look at the last year in Australia, we've got a guy in as geology manager there. Obviously, if we get listed, we'll be getting other management. They'll take over that. If we are looking at Kenya, once it reaches a certain stage, it'll need to be run, and we'll bring in people to do that. We already have got a couple of geologists working on it and a community relations person. And we have a community relations person, by the way, recruited in Australia, talking to the local people. If we're looking at Congo, we haven't got that back quite yet. But because each of these could be something we sell on or joint venture out or allow people to farm into and get our return that way, probably at least one of them ought to be that, because that gets money into our coffers to do the other things. But if any of them we chose to develop, we would have to have some transformation in the management of Red Rock to allow for people who can do that sort of work. We're having discussions at the moment on another Congolese asset, I've been talking to headhunters and people, because if we took on that asset, it would mean that it dwarfed everything else, and we'd have to really, in our own interests, in order to make money with our own shares, we'd have to bring in a new team to run the company, because the sums of money needing to be raised in short order would be so great. So we are constantly looking at this sort of thing, because nobody wants to be doing a job they can get someone else to do. But we're coming out of hibernation with two or three little pupa that aren't even beginning, one or two of them beginning to be caterpillars. But as they hatch and develop, they will either need management of their own, or the management of Red Rock will have to change. There's no question about that. In the year to come, we will need more executive management, and we will need a strengthened board, almost whatever happens. And we're already working on that. If one particular thing happens, we will have some very surprising changes.
Right. I think and the Chinese geologists being vaccinated, is that something which is on? Are you aware of that one? Is it relevant?
Yeah, I mean, we can get too granular on this, because I think I have mentioned to more than one person the frustration that the people who we were discussing some kind of joint venture with in one of our projects, who are Chinese, they have failed to come out of the country because they say they're waiting till they get the inoculation. And there's some rationale in that, because if they concluded with us, they would want to have their geologists and people working there immediately, And these are people who are state geologists in China. And they're not going to move until they're convinced it's safe. And they won't be convinced it's safe until they've been inoculated. So, yes, you know, I understand that. But in the meantime, we have written to them and said, we can't be held back from talking to other people by your problems there.
Right. Just a few points, I think, sort of on getting things done or things that you said might be done before. So Migori in Kenya, what kind of work is needed to get the JORC done there?
We got CSA onto the job of updating their JORC resource that they created in 2012-2013. And that was under what's called JORC 2004, which was the JORC code of Australia, one of the codes for reporting mineral resources, which if you're not compliant with, you can't use the words resource or reserve or give numbers. Well, the new version of that, a new edition, which is JORC 2012, and bringing the resource there into compliance with JORC 2012 was something we gave as a job to CSA late last year. Of course, there's been a slight break over Christmas and New Year, but partly that was because they came back with a question, which is, how much of the ore that we had at that time has been taken out by artisanal miners? And of course, the answer in one way is, well, probably not very much, but also you have to quantify that. They had also to get their heads around an awful lot of old data that these individuals haven't worked with before. For example, one part of that project has on our data, in our data room, 3.2 terabytes of data, and that's quite a lot. And they wanted to know things like, did we at that time, did we get sort of quarters of core to retest it to compare with old drilling depths? So, I mean, I said, well, a lot of that was done by your people and under their instructions, you might be able to find it. But as of the latest discussion, which was actually today, we're expecting something within days.
Right. The other thing, I suppose, was the Mount Ida iron ore royalty. Do you have any other royalties?
We do. I mean, we have, under the agreements we were discussing in Kenya with the Chinese, we were talking about retaining a royalty there. We have the royalty in Colombia that pays 3% on the production of that mine, and after for the next $1 million, and after that goes down to 1% for the next $2 million. We have on all our gold assets in Australia retained a royalty. So if we dilute there or float off or sell off some of it, we'd expect to retain that royalty.
Right. And the exotically named Luan Shimba, what's the current state of play there? Somebody asking a question about phase one, phase two, and when we might get an idea that what's in place there.
Yes, we're doing some geophysics, following up on the geochemistry we have done in a couple of programs. The geophysics, we've done the first phase, which is the ground geophysics, and that was on quite a larger area. And that's now being assessed. And then we'll go back and we'll do 12 line kilometers of IP. And that's 6 lines of 2 kilometers each. We have been working out exactly where to put them. What I would say is that the analysts there in Congo and in Canada, looking at it, they are more and more optimistic the more they look at it. So we're going to carry out that last bit of work, the IP, shortly. And then for the end of the rainy season, which will be end of March, beginning of April, we will be ready to drill.
Right. I just wanted to ask a final grumpy question. Well, there's a couple of grumpy questions, actually. One, I suppose, is I can almost answer myself. Somebody saying that, you know, basically over the, say, the 2010s, you were raising money and perhaps not getting as far as you could have gone. Let's say, presumably that's because there was a bear market in the mining space. So there wasn't going to be a party, whatever you did. And obviously you don't know necessarily what when you raise money for something and try and develop something, you don't actually know what the conditions are going to be when it's developed.
Yeah, I mean, it is certainly true that at that time we spent money exploring for iron ore in Greenland, which would have been a valid option to continue with, despite the huge expense of operating up there, if the iron ore price had remained close on $200. But as we all know, it didn't. And so we had to write off a lot of expense there. And I won't go into the detail of all that, but we had had to support a partner there too. In the other thing, of course, that set us back a bit was that our Kenyan project, we ended up in litigation with the government, which was extremely unfair. And we ended up with the right answer. But it took a long time, a lot of patience, a lot of diplomacy to get there. But we end up with it back and with good relations with the government and able to proceed. I have to say that, you know, being in the situation where we entered into the post-2010 downturn with debt, trying to get rid of that debt by raising money in equity did create some value destruction for existing shareholders. And that's one of the reasons why we're going to make sure that we aren't in a position of having net debt again. Because if you have, if you don't have a secure revenue model, then you have to be sure that you have cash.
But it's one of those things, I suppose, there's a couple of things there. Nobody was expecting all the conditions were right with QE for the mining sector to go through the roof as they are now. But the music just stopped in 2010. And anybody who didn't have a chair was stuck. I mean, is that right? I mean, it was almost as surprising as if tomorrow, let's say, in the end of January, the whole commodities boom finishes and everybody's, you know, left with no musical. The music stops then as well. Is that fair to say? It was a very unusual end.
It was, of course, a lot of people, big companies, were writing off $4 or $5 billion. We wrote off very small amounts, but I don't think we have anyone to blame except ourselves.
And so, let's say the music stopped tomorrow, would you now be in a much better position that you were than you were in the end of the previous that cycle, that 2008?
Absolutely, yes, because we could, we would expect to be able to liquidate and have net cash.
Right. Okay. I mean, I think there's one of the things here that just in asking you these questions and the questions coming in. Why are you getting involved in Vector, and haven't you got enough on your plate already? Which is sort of leads into the conversation, or follows on from the conversation that we've had over the last 45 minutes.
Yes, I mean, we're in two countries in Africa principally, which of course are Kenya and Congo. One speaks French, the other speaks English, but that doesn't matter very much. They actually both speak Swahili in the mining areas, I think we try to run ourselves as far as possible as a bilingual company, able to operate in French as well as in English. And our data manager we just recruited, who's a geologist, he is originally from French Africa, and he's now in London. He's bringing all of our data up to date and taking it and organizing it as it comes in. We feel we can handle Congo, a place that has defeated many companies, and a lot of the people it's defeated, I note, are the small companies that go in there from Australia and places like that, and they don't speak a word of French. And somehow, coming and going from Australia, and not speaking French, they expect to have instant success. And no, you have to do your apprenticeship in a country. You have to really understand it and know it, and you have to be top to bottom integrated with Congolese people, and that means the native Congolese. It doesn't mean Belgians or lawyers from Paris or anything like that. You really have to be using local people, working with them, talking to them, and having the problems that we had with, for example, unreliable lawyers, unreliable partners, and you work your way through them all, and you learn how to do business, and you get a large enough network of people who don't absolutely hate you, that you can start to prosper. So we have reached the level of comfort now that when something came up, which is probably almost a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, which is Vector had a 60% interest in the the Adichie-Kangkor mine, which was part of the Okilo mines, part of Okilomoto, owned by Sokimo, the power state that used was the successor of the Belgian company. That's Société Minière Okilomoto. And Kibali to the north, everybody knows about, because that's been developed by AngloGold Ashanti and Barrick, as I suppose the richest mine in Africa. But I think that what has been proven, AngloGold Ashanti had this one up to 2014 or so. They've proved, 3.2 million ounces at over 6 grams a ton. But they didn't take into account, even inferred, the results that might have been inferred around some of the holes they drilled, because AngloGold Ashanti is pretty conservative and the work wasn't followed up with that in mind. I think that in terms of the potential size there, it again is probably about the best mine in Africa. And it was stuck in this Australian company that really made an appalling mess of it. And they had a relationship with their local partner that turned toxic. And I don't think anyone was really covered in glory. And we happen to know all the different parties, including the secured lenders. And I kind of understand how administration works in Australia. And so we got in there and we have changed the dynamics on the ground. We've created space and time in which to maneuver. We're talking to all the parties. And it so happens that the local partner, 2 years ago, sitting by the swimming pool of a hotel in Lubumbashi, this guy, Guy Robert Lukama, said to me, he said, "I wish I'd met you 2 years ago." He said, "We should have a plan B." And he spoke to me about it. But then he got tempted back, even though Vector were having problems. Vector's real problem was because they didn't raise the money quickly enough and they announced too much. They got suspended in Australia. And then the suspension went on and on and on because they couldn't raise enough money. And the longer you're suspended for, the more difficult it becomes to raise the money. So they kind of were circling the plug hole for a while and went down. But this is a perfect opportunity to maybe get in and see what one could do there. If we got hold of that asset completely, then you'd actually have to be relaunching Red Rock as a slightly different company. If we just acted as agents or introducers or one of a consortium, there'd be a different answer. But going into a situation of administration like that, where there are lots of different people and parties involved, you can never quite be sure of the outcome because it's, on the one hand, it's a very transparent process. On the other, it's a very, it's a process where it constantly changes and it's difficult to satisfy everybody. And you have to be very aware of how the process works. But and I think we can do that side, but I also think we can do the relationship side in the Congo. So we're going to try to do that and see what comes out of it. But all I know is that something as potentially valuable as that, well, I think, you know, it's very easy to look at a target of over 10 million ounces or over 20 million ounces. We would never forgive ourselves if we didn't have a go. And I think that's what our shareholders expect from us. Not that we sit on our backsides collecting our salaries, whether they're very small or medium, but they expect us to really go the extra mile and put in the effort and try to increase value.
Yeah, I wasn't going to mention the S word, but somebody did ask about that. I presume that you feel that you've been remunerated in a suitably frugal manner over recent years.
Well, certainly, yes, and nobody's had any increases. But when I look at other companies, we do seem to be perhaps under remunerated. But, I think that I'm a reasonable size shareholder. And the thing that is very good is to have the management with a shareholding and option position that aligns them with the shareholders rather than being able to sit there and, as I say, do nothing or just rest on their laurels and prosper even if the company doesn't. Now, we may not always succeed, but I would hate for anyone ever to say that we didn't try.
Right. OK, well, so need to sort of sum up and close up now. I just wanted to go through, I mean, if you can just quickly give bullet points on each of the areas and the situations that you are. So Australia, what's the, you know, the next bullet point there? What are we waiting for there, and what are we looking at there?
In Australia, we're waiting for the grant of the first licenses. The moment we get that, we've got a team ready standing by to progress the listing process. We've already got the 43-101 carried out, ready. So that's the next thing there.
Right. And Kenya, apart from the vaccinated Chinese geologists?
Well, we've refurbished the camp and the vehicles and everything. We've got a team working on the ground with the communities and going and seeing all the chiefs and all the sub-chiefs and all the communities, which you have to do. It takes a little bit of time. And we've got exploration slated for this first quarter.
Okay. The Democratic Republic of Congo?
In the DRC, well, I'm heading out to Kenya and Congo now, and later this week. And in Congo, I think there's a necessity for one or two face-to-face meetings. But also, I think Luan Shimba is going to make progress. And I want to be there with the geologist to look at the results of this first phase so that we can all assess together how to take it forward.
And Greenland, I just had the question, a slightly grumpy one. Do you still have an interest there? Iron ore is up 300%.
I see. Iron ore is more or less back to where it was when we were last in Greenland at the beginning of this decade just ended. It was, of course, it was a potential huge opportunity because it was just by Baffin Island with what looked like an extension of the mineralization. Baffin Island was bought by the Mittals privately, has been developed and has been producing, and is probably the richest grade, highest grade iron ore in the world. But given the expense of operating up there, you cannot possibly, as a small company, be exploring it when the iron ore price has gone down to a level where you couldn't conceivably bring on a viable project. And for most of the last decade, that's been the position. So, yeah, you know, one of the things is we may be good, we may be bad, but in the end, the commodity price is master of us all. If the gold price is $1,800 or if it's $300, doesn't matter how good you are. Your project that's going to look very good at $1,800 is probably going to look as if you're an idiot if the price goes to $300. When the oil price was over $100, then went down to a bit over $20, it made the guys who were heroes look like villains. And the same thing happened with iron ore. I'm afraid that is just, what we can do is we can try to survive the down cycles, and we can try and learn and insulate ourselves from these things happening again. So I profoundly regret the fact that we didn't get out of that earlier, but we did get caught at the top of the market.
Right. And just find out in the questions whether you can answer them or not, in terms of the warrants position and the cash position, is there any insight into that area?
I think our cash position is reasonable at the moment. We don't expect to run short. We would hope that the price would go up to a level where people will exercise warrants. And we also would expect to see some realizations in the course of the year from transactions we enter into.
Okay, on that note, Andrew Bell, Chairman at Red Rock Resources, thank you very much indeed. I hope I've covered most things. It's been quite a sprawling...
One more question we have here. Andrew Jones come up saying, I said a new application to... Oh, no, that's the tailings. Tailings is actually not Musonoi. Tailings is in Kenya. We put in an application to go to a mining lease there before we got into this litigation. The ministry sat on it, arguably made it disappear. And this is one of the things we need to readdress, because that could be low-hanging fruit in Kenya, that we've got 1.5 million tons of tailings.
Right. Okay. And I think I just finally, there's a question which I've sort of answered before maybe, but are you still entertaining new opportunities, and how would you fund them if you decided to go for them?
Well, I think if you look at any company in our space, and you said you interviewed Parmetal Resources recently, if you said to them, well, look, if this project were one you bring into production, have you got enough money to bring it all the way to production? No, you haven't. No, we haven't. because if we had that much money sitting there idly at the moment, we'd be using money inefficiently. What we are doing is we're sitting at a certain part of the value curve, trying to add value or perceived upside. And if we do that successfully and bring the right people in, maybe we can raise the money to bring something into production wholly under our own steam. More likely always is that the amount of money involved and the grade of the deposit means that you either have to farm out to someone with a lower cost of capital, or you have to joint venture so that the project doesn't become too big for your size. So we've got enough for our immediate purposes. We've got enough to give existing shareholders real upside and leverage if we have good discoveries or identify something that we can definitively say we'll make a mine.
And just a flippant question, what could be the expected share price of Triple R in this year?
I saw, Mr. Butt, your question there, and that is tempting fate, and I leave that to Zach to predict.
Yes, I was going to come up with an answer, but maybe I'll address that on a direct directly, not in public.
Okay, I think we're in a good place, and as I say, I think we only need one thing to go right to do very well this coming year. So as we start off the year in a much better place than we did last year, in that we have several horses running, and we only need one of them to finish the race this year, and the rest can run again next year. But if we can get more than one to finish the race this year, very good. But I'd be quite optimistic we make good progress in Kenya, maybe do a deal there. In Congo, I'd be quite disappointed if we couldn't do at least one deal there. And I think, surprisingly, on our own licensee, exploration is going rather well. Then I think Australia, the odds are extremely high that we will be able to get that listed, which is going to be positive. And so what can I say? I think we're in a good place. And I like the commodities that we're principally exposed to, gold and copper. I think, again, we're in the right place in terms of commodity exposure, which is probably not our skill, but is just, that's the market.
Okay, Andrew, it's been a pleasure. Hopefully one day we can have a webinar on politics and history and all the stuff that we both really like, but I'm not sure what the audience would be there on that particular front.
Very simple audience.
Yes, right. So thank you very much indeed, and hopefully see you again and speak to you again soon.
Thanks, Zach.
Cheers.
Thank you for listening. Remember to visit our website for more news and other podcasts at www.share-talk.com.